crying, David, I'm an addict. And proud to say that I have friends in Louisville. It's been gray and it's been cold and it's been beautiful. And people have been very kind to me. And Nene has been very, very good to me. Let me ask, has anybody not been hugged today?
If you'd like to reach us, our internet address is this morning.
Yeah, there's a hand. Okay, somebody has not been hugged. For that person, could everybody hug his neighbor?
You deserve a hug.
Oh yeah, you got one. Now that was. We follow directions well. And sometimes we think that means let's hug everybody. But it serves as a good excuse to get three extra hugs. I like the theme of this convention, the ties that bind us together. I was sort of asleep the first time I heard it, and I thought, oh no, they're talking about bondage? But I said, no, that can't be it. It's about our connections. It's about our connections to the whole and to humanity and to God. And I seek today to forge stronger connections to reality and to God and to my fellow addicts and to my fellow humans and to my fellow creatures. One of the things that I've been taught is never underestimate the power and energy of spirit, that we all have a spiritual connection, and that all the universe breathes with life if I'm willing to make a connection to it, if I'm willing to unite with it. You know, some people will call it the force, some people will call it God, some people will call it spirit. And I think it's less important that you what you call it than that you call on it. I've grown weary over the years with games of my God's better than your God. I believe that there's a weakness to some religious faith in that it tends to be narrow, in that it tends to be exclusive rather than inclusive. And I believe God wants everybody under his tent and doesn't care what he calls them. It's we who care what we call God or how we call God, or what names, or what forms. All I know is it's wise to never limit our relationship to God, to never set arbitrary limits. It's a natural thing for us to do. After all, we're human, and we face our limitations every day. We're addicts, we certainly know those limitations. But I have a lot of connections. The ties that bind us together include our relationship. The fact that we have been in relationship to each other as recovering addicts. You know, we have lived a lot of the same life. We have a lot of the same memory, similar values, similar character and experience. We also have a common need and a common program. All these are ties that bind us together and make us feel united and give us a sense that we belong to each other. I need you. It's very important for me to remember that I'm not an island, that I can't stand alone, that I need my fellow addicts. They show me the way. They give me a sense of what's real. There's times that at a mere 12 and 3/4 years clean, I find myself the person in the room with the most clean time around my hometown a lot of the time. And didn't used to feel that way. My first couple of conventions, you know, 9/10 of the people had a lot more time than me. And now I find myself in the top 10 most of the time. And it's a little scary what happened to all those people. Why did they forget the ties that bind us together? Did life become so good, or did life become so bad, or did recovery become so boring? I believe it's up to me to keep my recovery exciting. I believe it's up to me to refresh it and to bring life to it and to ask God into it on a constant basis. There's ties that tear us apart. You know, I used to think, how could ties tear us apart? Well, it's ties to other things, ties to the past, ties to drugs, ties to addiction, ties to sick family and friends, and ties to the disease of addiction. One of my old friends said, when addicts say, I'm so sick, they're really saying, I'm so cool, I'm so cool. We tend to glorify the disease. I don't like stepping up and doing a big long war story. I realize that I have to qualify. What's your qualification? Well, I'm an addict. I used for 15 years. How fortunate I am to qualify. Well, but the real nature of my disease, I've been taught, is self-obsession. And that means that I get wrapped up in myself, caught up in me, I, my, mine. But enough about me, tell me what you think about me. But that's the nature of my obsession, is running everything through the filter of me. And I believe that the main task of my program of recovery and my spiritual awakening is shifting my focus from self-centeredness to God-centeredness, and putting God at the center of my universe on a consistent basis, including all of my decisions. I find that if I'm not consulting God on the major decisions of my life, then I'm running on self-will. Other aspects of my disease related to self-obsession are isolation. And I can sit home alone for a whole weekend, and even get annoyed when the phone rings if I'm in my disease. Paranoia. Part of my story is that I used to use behind three locked doors. I used to use in my bathroom, with the front door, the bedroom door, and the bathroom door all locked, because I could hear every cop in the world outside my front door. So keen was my hearing. Actually, I think it was all in my mind. Egomania. I had a sick ego. Now, I believe it's not God's will for me to have no ego. There are some addicts who believe that their ego has to die. And I don't know that that's true. I think that God wants me to have an ego. He created me with one. He just wants me to have a healthy one. When I was a little kid, they said, take pride in your appearance, take pride in yourself. Don't walk around, hunched over, looking at the ground. Stand up straight. Take pride in yourself. But I think that's what's meant by a healthy ego. That I'm not better than everybody, but I'm not worse than everybody either. And I don't have to be ashamed of myself. And another major aspect of my self-obsession is arrogance, which is more than pride, because there is a healthy pride. Arrogance is my belief that I am the only one with the answers, that I'm the only one who's important, that I'm the only one with solutions or with something worth saying. A lot of times, for a person who's arrogant, a conversation is just waiting for somebody to finish so I can talk again. It's a major aspect of my recovery has been learning how to listen, learning how to open my ears and open my heart and not be rehearsing what I'm going to say. There have been times in my recovery that I've had to go through sharing fasts of not saying anything in meetings for like a week at a time, just so I know I won't be rehearsing anything. So I'll be listening. So I'll be opening my heart and my mind and my ears to what others have to say. Because as you may have gathered already, I've always got something to say. And it's important for me sometimes not to. The real nature of my recovery is progressive awakening and disillusionment. Progressive awakening because many aspects of my nature have been asleep. In particular, my spirit was asleep. That's why I need a spiritual awakening, so my spirit can be awake. If the spirit is asleep, who's in charge? The intellect? The ego? The emotions, God forbid? If those aspects of my nature are in charge, I'm in serious trouble. Because, you know, it's like the horse is deciding which fork to take in the road rather than the driver. It's important for me to be spirit-centered. And if my spiritual nature is what is in charge, then I'm usually intuitive and making right decisions and thinking about what's in the best interest of all concerned rather than just what will make me look good. Disillusionment. When I was a kid, I thought that that was something terrible. You know, because of the way people used it in context and sentences, they said, oh, he was disillusioned with life, as though somehow everything had disappointed him. That's not really all that disillusionment means. It means to divest yourself of your illusions, to give up your deluded nature, to stop kidding yourself. And I believe that it's very important for my recovery to continue to accept disillusionment as a goal. It's very good for me to give up my illusions. My illusions about life, my illusions about myself, my illusions about God. One of the illusions which served me for a little while was using addiction as what I call the demon model. Now, I don't believe in demonic possession per se, but it's a good model. Because that's a lot of the way addiction has acted in my life. I felt like I was possessed. I felt like there was an alien intelligence in my head that was doing the thinking for me. I felt as though I wanted to do the right thing, but I was almost being forced to do the wrong thing. And like I said, I don't believe I was possessed by demons, because if the demons have been cast out, why do I still have the disease of addiction? See? But it's a useful model, because it's as though a portion of my mind had begun to dominate all the rest of my mind. And that portion of my mind was the disease of addiction. It's as though it, at certain points, it became dominant and it began to occupy the whole house. And getting clean confined it to one room, and the door was locked. But the disease is still alive. It's still in that little room, and any time it can jump out of that room and go, ta-da, I'm still here. The disease of addiction can still dominate my thinking if I allow it to, and if I stop being vigilant, and if I forget how important my recovery is, how central it is to my life, how important it is to stay tuned in to God's will for me. I can overcome and prevail. It would be wrong to assume that the disease is so powerful that it has the capacity to dominate my consciousness on a constant basis. Left to only my own resources, I'm helpless against the disease of addiction. But armed with the program of recovery, with my higher power, with the love of my fellow addicts, and with the fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous and the meetings I attend, my spiritual efforts, armed with all of that, the disease is no match for me. That's because I have the weapons and armor to defend myself. Left to my own devices, I'm defenseless. But it's a mistake to assume that the disease will keep growing whatever we do. The literature says the disease can be arrested at some point and recovery is then possible. If that were not true, then I would be sicker than ever today. And I don't believe that's true. I believe I've made progress in defeating my disease. Has it been defeated? No, I'm afraid not. That's why I keep coming back. There's a lady in my area who says she wondered why all her character defects were not removed at once. And she said she finally figured it out. That's God's way of keeping us around. That's God's way of causing us to stick around so we keep helping somebody else. You know, if I thought that all my defects had been removed, I would say, great, got mine, see ya. But because I still see my defects and still know I need the program of recovery. I still keep coming back. And I still need the program. So I'm still here to give it away. And a lot of the program for me is about dealing with pain and dealing with life. I mean, there is pain. And there's pain of boredom. There's pain of disappointment. Oh, okay. There's pain of sorrow. About 5 years ago, we lost my mom. And she had had 20 years of cancer. It wasn't a surprise. And her last year was very painful to watch her deteriorate. But I had a program. And one of the things my mother whispered to me one day, because I'd given her so much of my time in her pain, she said, "You're my hero." And I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "Because you show me how to live more lightly." And my mother was a very spiritual woman, but for a change, she believed I was teaching her. I was probably the only one in the family who wasn't unafraid of what she was going through. She was on a lot of drugs. She was taking enough morphine that could have killed the rest of the family put together. And she would sometimes act like an addict and have panic attacks and say, "What? Where?" I'd say, "Mom, it's the drugs." "Oh yeah, it's the drugs." The rest of the family didn't have a drug frame of reference to understand what she was going through. And it was painful, but it was not unbearable because I had a program. And I was the black sheep of the family, and I was the one they asked to do the eulogy. Things have changed. Recovery restores us to more than just sanity. It restores us the love and the heart of our families. It restores us to reality if we let it. Oh, sometimes I can still be pretty unrealistic, but it's getting better. One of the insights that the program has given me is that my world is like me. I believe very much in vibration and the power of the vibrations I put out to draw the reality to me. So I believe that if you believe that the world is a terrible, dangerous, ugly place, that's what it becomes for you. If you believe it's a dog-eat-dog existence, that's what it becomes. If you believe that the world is full of love and full of hope, then that's what it becomes for you, too. And there's one philosopher who says that it's not true when people say, if I'll believe it when I see it. It's more true to say, I'll see it when I believe it. That what we really need to do is change how we believe. And when we do that, life and reality changes. We become different people. Life becomes different for us. I believe that God uses us all. That in little subtle ways, God is always using us in the lives of other people. That there's like a web or an interconnection of energy between us and everyone around us. And that we're all needed. We're spiritually necessary for the planet. Nobody is to waste. Nobody is expendable. Every soul is part of the plan. But within that plan, there's lots of flexibility. I believe that there's a random element to creation. I don't believe that the universe was programmed from the very beginning. I don't believe that we're puppets on a string. That God intentionally decided, this is just my belief, you don't have to believe this way. I believe that God intentionally decided, I don't want to know everything in advance, and I don't want to manipulate everything in advance. I want to create creatures that can think for themselves and make their own decisions. Now to me, if I were God, I would create robots. Because that's what I know, that's what people do. People create robots, God creates people. We would create people in our image, but God creates us in His image. Meaning, creative, able to think for ourselves, able to handle and manage reality for ourselves, and able to make differences in the world. Were it not so, then we would be puppets on a string. We would just be automatons, mechanisms, that doesn't seem to be what we are. We seem to have minds of our own. The reason why that's important is because sometimes we think we want God to do our thinking for us, or sometimes we want a convenient excuse like saying the devil made me do it. Well, I'm capable of enough damage all by myself without saying the devil made me do it, if I believed in a devil. I've been told that I need to qualify, and I'll tell you the story very briefly. I used for 15 years. I started using in January of 1970, and I kept using until March of 1985. And I would be lying to you if I told you that it didn't work. The drugs worked for a while. I was a depressed and angry teenager. I was pissed off at my family and at the world. I was too idealistic. I believed that life should be much better than it was, that life was unfair, and that I was being singled out and picked on. In fact, I was. I was laughed at by the class and picked on by the bullies when I was a youngster. I wonder why. Because I was weird. You know, I was different. And coming to NA, I found a lot of people who were just as different, who were just as weird, who felt just as much as though they were from Mars, some other heavenly body. At least most of us felt like we weren't from here, wherever here was. And when I discovered drugs in 1970, I thought I had found home. I thought that I had found my ticket to Nirvana. Now, this was the shortcut. I would no longer have to be depressed and anxious and angry all the time. And for years it worked. I would write under the influence and it seemed to all flow beautifully. Well, wonder why it didn't make sense the next day. You know, I would have these wonderful insights and somehow they never seemed to last. But I certainly felt more relaxed and less angry. So for a while drugs seemed to work. And then gradually, as drugs didn't work or worked less and less, I turned to harder drugs. First I was just using pot and hallucinogens, and then eventually started using cocaine. And that was a sufficient bottom. And I'm a great believer in sufficient bottoms. And all that means is, if you hurt enough, if you were in enough pain, if you were desperate enough, you know, maybe that's enough for an addict to say, somebody please help me. Because as an addict, the last thing I would do would be admit that I needed help. My resistance to help was enormous. My tendency was to believe that if I admitted that I needed help, somebody would take my freedom away. But actually, my freedom had long since been taken away by my addiction. I was just living an illusion.
The next time they come for me,
the bottom? Well, at the bottom, I had been fired from my job. I was being kicked out of my apartment. I had the lights turned off. I had the phone turned off. And there was crust in the kitchen sink this thick. And I hadn't changed the cat box in 2 weeks. And so the whole apartment stank pretty bad. In other words, I was non compos mentis.
I'm Frank Collar.
I was an incompoop. I had lost a composed state of mind, and I was unable to string more than two sentences together and make any sense. Which for a talker like me is very hard. And my mother said, because, you know, everybody knows you're an addict before you do. My mother said, if you don't get help, we're not going to help you anymore. She thinks it's a means of her own. And, yeah, thank God. And, so I went to this one meeting in like November of 1984, and I saw these spoiled middle class kids with their spoiled middle class problems, and I wanted to go home and get high. And that's what I did. But I didn't get back to a meeting until about 3 months later, when things had gotten a lot worse. And my mother said, there's a meeting on the University of Miami campus, and it's called Recovery, and I want you to go. And I went. And this one I liked. They were talking about solutions, and they were talking about steps. And, you know, nearly 13 years later, that's still my home group. It's called Recovery, and it is what it says. It's about the steps and the traditions. Every week they talk, they have a speaker share on the steps and the traditions. And they began to make sense, and I believe that it worked for addicts, but I didn't know yet that it worked for me, so I still had to do treatment. So on March 21st, 1985, I went into a treatment center, a very good one, they tell me. And we managed to spend $11,000 for them to teach me how to come to NA for free. But you know, I'm not against treatment because it's a buffer. It's a period of transition between that old cruel world and a new world of recovery. And it serves to give people a chance to look at issues and to start talking and to start thinking in different ways. I'm not morally opposed to treatment, but I don't think it's indispensable to recovery. I know addicts who have come straight from the streets and gotten wonderful clean time and wonderful recovery in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous without having to pay a doctor a dime. So, you know, either way, we're glad you're here. That's what's important. My first meetings were a little confusing. That same group called Recovery, it met in Wesley Hall at University of Miami campus, and the front of the room was like a circle of benches or sofas, and behind that were rows of chairs. And when I would come to that meeting, I thought you had to be somebody special to sit on those sofas. And it was only a couple of years later that I found out, no, you just had to get there first. This is the kind of mythology that develops in the minds of addicts. We're very good at myth-making. What I began to realize is that the addicts that meant the most to me personally were those with a robust sense of humor. I began to realize that humor was completely indispensable to a program of recovery. That without it, I would be taking myself too damn seriously. I need to break crystallization. I need to shatter hardened forms in my thinking and in my life. And humor serves most for that for me. When I take on new sponsees, I usually tell them, I want you to watch humor regularly. I want you to watch stand-up comedy. You know, whether you go to stand-up comics or whether you watch them on TV, I don't care. But sitcoms won't do. They're too frustrating. I mean, you know, humorous philosophy. Look at things in new ways. And about 5 years ago, I began to compile a joke book because I knew so many jokes. I'm now just about ready to publish. And my friends tell me this could be a really, you know, best-selling joke book. Only jokes that made me laugh personally. I wouldn't tell jokes that didn't make me laugh personally. Like, do you guys know the difference between an addict and an alcoholic? They'll both steal your wallet, but the addict will help you look for it for half an hour. And do you know the difference? You know how many addicts it takes to change a light bulb? There's several versions of that, but my favorite is two. One to come up with the $10 and the other to promise to be right back with the light bulb. And do you know what many addicts are using for contraception these days? Their personality. There's the story of the young idealistic public defender who's interviewing his first client. It's an addict, of course, who has been unjustly accused and arrested, of course. So the public defender says, so why did you get arrested? And the addict says, so help me. The only reason I was arrested was for sneezing. What a travesty of justice, says the lawyer. How could you be arrested just for sneezing? Well, that's what woke up the night watchman. So, oh, just a few more. I'll skip over those. Two businessmen are chatting in the elevator. One says, my wife's pocketbook was stolen with all of her credit cards, but I haven't reported the theft. His friend says, my God, man, why not? He says, because the thief is spending less than my wife did. Well, the rabbi and the minister are on a plane together. Aisle mates. The stewardess is coming down the aisle with the drinks cart, and she says to the rabbi, can I get you anything to drink, sir? And the rabbi says, you know something, I'm not much of a drinker, but just this time, maybe I'll have a whiskey sour. And she says to the minister, anything for you, sir? He says, young lady, I'll have you know, I would sooner commit adultery than have strong liquor cross my lips. The rabbi says, oh, I didn't know there was a choice. I'll have what he's having. Okay, one more. This man says to God, God, what's a million years to you? God says, a second. Man says, God, what's $1 million to you? God says, a penny. Man says, God, can I have a penny? God says, sure, in a second. Which to me suggests that God is not an enabler. Now, if you produce a book or a tape called Find Out How Codependent You Really Are, real codependents would not read it, but they'd buy 3 copies for their friends who really needed it. So what's so important about codependency and enabling? What's so important is that I've run the risk of enabling my sponsees. You scratch most addicts and you find a codependent underneath. You know, we're people pleasers. We want so much to be wanted. We want so much to be needed. A great deal of the course of my recovery has been about becoming more secure within myself. I believe that at the very nub of my disease of addiction is a profound sense of insecurity. Fear that the world will not be what I want it to be. Fear that I won't be happy. Fear that I won't be fulfilled. That as I gain security from my recovery, from my fellows, from my heart, and from my God, there's less and less reason why I need to fear reality, less and less reason why I need to be insecure. Of course, old habits die hard. And sometimes we want so much to be liked or loved, and we'll say anything. One of the essential tasks I've learned with sponsees is to have healthy boundaries, is to say thus far and no further, is to say, you know what, I'm a worthy person too, and you know, if you're driving me crazy, then I won't have anything to give away. I do not believe this is a selfish program. I don't know where that came from. I think from addicts who wanted to be selfish, maybe. Or make excuses for their selfishness. I've been told this is an unselfish program for selfish people. But if there's any way that it's selfish, it's only in this sense. I have to have enough for me in order to give it away. If I've given everything I have away, then I have nothing left for me, and I have nothing to replenish what I'm giving it away from. There's a saying that giving is proof of having. If I don't have any big left, how can I give? I need some time for me, I need some space for me, and I need some healthy boundaries. You know, every one of us have some insights and some spiritual observations we can share with each other. One I would like to share with you is that we are all light workers in training. We're learning how to be light bearers. We're carrying wisdom and illumination to others. We do it every day. If you've had a sponsee that you shared something with and you've seen the light come on in their eyes, you're a light worker. You're sharing God with somebody. You're helping them to wake up spiritually. There is no higher calling. What we do every day is magnificent. And, you know, I hear occasionally speakers say about the spiritual part of the program. There isn't a spiritual part of the program. It's all spiritual. Every bit of it. You don't think that saving lives and changing from wretched lunatics to honored citizens and sponsoring and celebrating and serving and conquering a killer disease is spiritual? If not, then what is? What we do is consistently spiritual, but let's not make such a big deal out of it because it's an anonymous program. It's important for me not to be that important. But see, my disease compels me to go looking for trouble. My disease is very into attachment to the negative. Woe is me. Self-pity is one of the most major aspects of my ongoing disease of addiction, feeling sorry for myself. The first assignment I was given by my first sponsor was to write a gratitude list. Now that's still the same assignment I give to sponsors today. I tell them everything, animal, vegetable, mineral, anything you're grateful for, write it down. What we find out when we've done that is we've counted our blessings. Which I always took to be a corny saying, oh, count your blessings, yeah, right. Turns out, I'm very blessed. I'm a lucky guy. Or, more accurately, I'm blessed. God has been good to me. It's important that my program give me perspective in all aspects, whether it's humor or illumination or meditation, are all served to help me take myself out of myself so that I can look at myself with a little bit more perspective and not be quite so biased in my own favor. It's still true that I can never see myself quite as others see me. That's why I need a sponsor. You know, at 12 and almost 13 years, I don't really need somebody to teach me the steps. But I still need somebody's perspective. I still will never have a completely unbiased perspective about myself. What I've learned is that I was a very frustrated person, and that an increase of perspective has given me more of a sense of ironic amusement rather than frustration. It's like, you know, when does serenity come in? When I'm halfway through a traffic jam. When am I up against my defects of character and particularly my shortcomings, a lack of patience? Halfway through a traffic jam. I have enough patience to get halfway through a traffic jam. I just don't have enough patience to get all the way through a traffic jam. Somewhere there in the middle, I have to call on God and say, God, I'm losing it because I'm going, come on, Grandma. And it's not Grandma's fault. There's a million cars in front of us. So that's when I say, God, I've run out of patience. Please give me more. And he does. And I detach from the immediate focus, and I realize that this traffic jam is nobody's fault. It's only a circumstance, not an emergency. And for me, that has become a vital phrase of my recovery. Whatever it is, it's only a situation, not an emergency. My disease wants me to make an emergency out of everything. If I get excited enough, I might do something crazy or use over it, God forbid. If we do recover, though, we have to change what we call ourselves. We have to stop calling ourselves sick and suffering addicts. If we're in recovery, I have a disease, but I'm not sick. My disease, God willing, if I'm working the program, is in a state of increasing remission. It no longer has the power to totally dominate my consciousness in my life. I have alternatives to it. And using is still an alternative. Using is still a choice. But instead of choice number 2, it's now choice number 73. If you're way down the list, there's a lot of things I can do before using now. Not just pray and go to meetings and call your sponsor. There's a lot of other things. Sometimes turning on Comedy Central and watching a comedian make me laugh is one of those alternatives. Sometimes just washing my face in cold water is an alternative. I don't believe also that we continue to call ourselves hopelessly compulsive, because I believe that we become, as we progress, less and less the victim of compulsion. Compulsion is where you're grabbed by the throat and forced to do something. The disease has less domination of our consciousness, and we actually can shake ourselves loose from that sense of compulsion if we believe we can. And again, I believe it has a lot to do with your self-concept and your God concept and your universe concept. If you believe it's true for you, then it is. If you believe you're helpless and in the grip, and if you believe that at any moment you might do something desperate, then that's true for you. But if you believe you're strong, and if you believe you're capable and competent, I'm not saying this happens overnight. I'm just saying that a lot of this has to do with what we convince ourselves of. You know, I stopped smoking 7 years ago with the use of group hypnosis. My sister told me to come with her to the group hypnotist. And the guy went through a whole rap, and he said, you've been giving yourself the wrong suggestions. And I'm an addict in recovery. I hear the word suggestions. So my ears perk up. He said, you've been telling yourself, oh, I can't do this. it's too hard for me. Other people can quit smoking, but I can't. He said, you've been telling yourself all the wrong suggestions, and you've been programming your subconscious wrong. I'm here to give you the right suggestions. And he said, that stuff's not for me, and I'm strong enough to stay off it, and so forth. He gave me a whole string of right suggestions.
Let me understand.
And he said that hypnosis is something you do to yourself every day. You access your subconscious, which is just this vast computer with no judgment. And you put stuff in it. You file things away. What's important is to realize that we can reprogram ourselves. We can change our programming with God's help, with the steps, with a sponsor's help, with repetition. Because it takes some repetition to break through the crystallization. Things get frozen in there. It's like chipping away at ice. Sometimes to make it a dent, you have to do some chipping. But, sorry. Above all, I'm a great believer in simple spirituality. I've been through a lot of religious observances. I don't impose any religious observances on anybody or recommend that. I grew up in a Jewish family. I have a lot of that information. I went to an esoteric school of esoteric Christianity. I have some of that information. I've studied in Buddhism and in Hinduism and some Islam and in some New Age philosophy, and I'm a competent astrologer. And none of that is going to make me go to heaven. None of that is going to save my life, and none of that is going to save me from addiction. If it had, it would have. Not that I'm against any religious practices, if it is real for you and if it works for you. Because what's important is making contact with a loving higher power. And if your religious observance helps you get there, that's what's important. But I believe in getting on a first name basis with God. God, David. David, God. None of this Lord stuff. And thee and thou and thou and, amen. What's important to me is a direct and intimate contact as though God is my personal friend. And I wouldn't talk to my personal friends that way, so I don't talk to God that way. I also talk to God as though he's right here all the time right now. I believe in de-ritualizing and demystifying my spirituality, keeping it very simple. I also let God know that I'm willing to cooperate. God, I'll do what I have to, and I'll do what you want me to. And I say that not for his sake, but for my sake, because God already knows what's in my heart. I have to make the connection. When I don't want to do the wrong thing, I ask God for help. There's times I want to do the wrong thing. But I've learned enough now that it's only going to hurt me, so I ask God for help. You could say, God, I'd rather die than do that depraved thing, whatever that is. And God will say, good, then I'll remove both desires. You don't have to die, and you don't have to do that depraved thing. Or do anything sick. So go live and do something healthy. God wants me to do healthy stuff. Now, God goes with me everywhere. I don't think there's anywhere I can hide from God, so there's no special place I have to go to pray. But many of us wouldn't want our parents along, nagging us when we had to face challenges. Fortunately, God isn't like that at all. God is not like my parents. God would not shake his finger at me and say, didn't I tell you? Didn't I warn you? The God of my understanding is consistently forgiving, consistently and constantly above blame and retribution and trying to get even. What's important for God is only that I make contact and that I love him and that I show my love to others. There's a saying, with God behind me, who can stand against me? And that doesn't mean that there won't be defeats in my life. There have been. What it means is that I won't lose heart. That if I'm standing with God, I won't lose heart. And ghosts and fantasies can't scare me when I have God. I believe that a lot of what is residue of my disease of addiction is that I've I sort of created a fantasy life of ghosts.
That's what he's talking about.
Some of those were like spiritual fantasies.
And surely he has an audience for that.
But they evaporate when I have a real conscious contact.
There's a different audience in mind. They're written.
And when I bring God along, life is an adventure rather than a sorrow. When I'm really making contact, I'm not sorry for myself, and my life is not a tragedy. And I'm at peace when I know that God has called me away from the war. I don't have to live in constant conflict anymore. I know some addicts who believe that they're here to do great battle against the forces of evil. And I don't think that's what my life is supposed to be about. I think my life is about sharing light.
His whole persona is to mask all that.
Being a light worker, raising consciousness, helping others. There's a lot of political turmoil that's happened in the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous. I don't know if any of you have ever noticed. A lot of that has to do with, frequently, two people with equally good ideas who just see things differently and who really mean the best for NA. I don't believe that any of the people who are in conflict in NA want to tear NA apart or mean to hurt NA. They just have differing visions. Sometimes I believe that there's foolishness involved. Sometimes I believe that there's self-aggrandizement involved. But I never believe that people are really out to harm NA. So I want to give everybody the benefit of the doubt. The important thing is, however, to raise consciousness, because an informed and conscious and aware and awake fellowship will make the right decisions.
I don't disagree. I don't think irritation is the.
If you keep everybody dumb and asleep, then they'll want somebody else to make the decisions for them. Each other, if we raise each other's consciousness, then we'll make the right decisions. We'll make selfless and conscious decisions. I have hope when I realize that God has cleared a path out of the woods for me, and He uses Narcotics Anonymous as the guideposts. I have faith, even though I may never know for sure what faith entails. See, it seems that for God to work in my life, I have to employ faith as the connecting circuit. If I don't use faith, then I don't make contact.
This is a more targeted.
Utter certainty is not given, because relying on God requires faith, not proof. We keep asking God for proof.
And many of them were.
When what we really need is faith.
Stratford people, Stratford attendees.
I don't know why God has chosen to be invisible, but that is obviously the case. Nobody has proven that to me yet. I can see the effects of God in my life. There's a saying we hear in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous that a coincidence is merely God's way of acting anonymously. I believe that a miracle is God's way of breaking His anonymity. And we see miracles every day, if we're looking for it. But you know, there's an equal way of looking at things. It's called science. And there's nothing wrong with a scientific viewpoint. But at the same time, I have to build my faith. You know, I gain a lot from the Star Wars movies, just as a very pop culture way of looking at spirituality. If you watch Luke Skywalker, whenever he loses faith and concentration, he loses connection to the Force. It's a matter of habit and training. We have to train our spirituality. We have to train our faith. Faith isn't something you just get and then that's all. Faith becomes a habit of mind. It becomes a pattern of doing things and a habit of thought. And as we train our faith, and as we become, more and more in contact with God and used to making contact, our faith becomes still simple, but more able, more strong, more able to do unusual things in our lives. Faith does come naturally, but it does not come normally. In other words, you can go through life completely without faith. And I've known people who were happy, decent people with no faith. No faith in God, anyway. So it's not like you have to know God. But if you're an addict, you probably want to know God. And just as connecting with good requires our faith, so connecting with evil requires our fear. When we have faith and fear not evil, then evil vanishes. How would you like to live in a reality where there is only God and no devil? You can. Fear not. You can destroy evil by conquering your fear. You will not do anything foolish or desperate if you are at peace and secure and calm and aware and at home in the love of God. As long as we follow that way, we have nothing to fear. It's a matter of what you're focused on. If I'm armed with God in the program, I have nothing to fear. I also believe that I'm called on to radiate light and wish for healing and ask for grace and project help and embrace hope and lend faith. These are all activities of faith, and to do it all with assurance of faith. When your faith doesn't waver, then the laser beam of your light aims true. It's primarily fear that causes my light to waver. When I'm not afraid, then my aim is more sure. Like an art or a talent, activities of spirit must be encouraged and trained and strengthened and used and developed, like a muscle. You keep growing stronger and more agile from spiritual practice, regardless of age. Unlike other talents and skills, you don't get poorer as you get older. The aged seer is still in top form when we're sharing wisdom. I also think that God chooses those who choose God. If we reach for God and if we yearn for God with all of our strength and faith, then we become one of God's chosen. In other words, to be chosen, you have to do the choosing. It's not like God singled me out. Okay? I've been looking for God for 42 years. If you look for God long enough, you find something. I just haven't found everything. So the search continues. I continue to look for more revelation and for more understanding and for more sense of unity and connection. I believe that we have to use who we are and what we know to get to God. We have to learn more about ourselves and reality and the world to access more of God. And the more we know who we are, the more we know who God is. If I'm out of touch with my own reality, how can I have a reality of God? The more we know creation, the more we know the Creator. That's why I believe science is so important. I'm interested in geography and physics and chemistry and biology and all this stuff. I don't believe that any of this is alien from a connection to God. That the more informed I am, the better a tool I can be for God's will. You know, there's some people who say, well, why see the doctor? Shouldn't you pray for healing? I believe God works through doctors. How do we know that somebody wasn't inspired by God to want to be a healer? But that's equally an agency of God's grace. Now, sometimes people in my life are negative, and I just can't help that. You know, I was just sharing before with friends that on New Year's Day, the stupidest thief in all of Miami broke into my car. And when he found out he couldn't pry loose my radio, my stereo, he just stole the faceplate from my radio. And it's useless to him. It just costs $75 to me to replace. You know, I sometimes have to respond to negative input. Sometimes that negative input, that friction, forces me to grow a little. There's a guy in my area who lives a few blocks from me, and that's the only thing he has in common with me. You know, he's perhaps one of the most negative people in the area, and he has no car, so he calls me for rides. And the other day I had two calls on my answering machine from this guy asking me for rides, and I wanted to get all irritated with this guy. And then I realized I should sit and write about it. And the first thing I said was, recovery will go easier for you when you start to take suggestions. And then I realized, but that's not the only message. There's more. Recovery will be more real for you when you share your real struggle with addiction. Recovery will be more accessible when you surrender your anger and stop looking for someone to blame. Recovery will fit you more comfortably when you start to show real compassion for others' problems. Recovery will seem to be more yours by right when you give up trying to manipulate or intimidate others. Recovery will blossom in your life when you look for someone you can help rather than to help you. Recovery will be a more natural state for you when you learn healthier ways to manage stress. Recovery will finally have energy, meaning, and escape velocity for you when you put the power of God at the center of it. Recovery will seem more genuine to you when you stop trying to deceive God, yourself, and others. Recovery will be part of you when you eagerly look for ways to practice principles. And recovery will never leave you once you learn to dedicate all its fruits to God. So what started as me trying to lecture this guy turned into something I needed as I sat and wrote out sort of the attitudes of recovery for myself, things that I needed to hear. God can use us all, and sometimes God uses us to help others and in the process heals us. It's funny how that happens. I might have been stuck up, I might have been foolish, I might have been out of touch, and I needed God to say that to me. In the end, it wasn't for this guy who may never hear this. It was for me. Discovering God is very subtle. It requires sensitivity and experience, and courage, reason, and faith. I don't believe that our faith needs to be unreasonable. Without using all these, we make contact with our dream of God rather than with God. Can I say that I know there's a God because he saved my life? No, because there's others' lives that were not saved. And that fact does not prove that there wasn't a God. Can I say I prove God because nature is so vast and wonderful? No, all natural phenomena, however wonderful, can be explained scientifically. Ignorance of science is not proof of God. Can I say that I know God because I've had inspired visions and ideas? No, everyone has a higher mind. And even though they're not always fully engaged, everyone carries a body of wisdom. Often it's gleaned from other people or from long forgotten incidences. And everyone can imagine or even hallucinate visions of paradise. This doesn't mean a visit of the spirit. Can I say God is with me because of amazing coincidences? No, Ripley's is full of coincidences. And those only add to the sureness of my faith. They can't cause it or support the full weight of it. Can I say I found God because I'm innately spiritual? No, because we're not. We are all innately spiritual, every one of us. We're also all innately intellectual, emotional, and physical. We all have all these things. We possess each of these centers. We're just each differently self-developed. Can I say God chose me for a special mission, so he made himself known to me? No, for everyone has a unique purpose, though not everyone is self-conscious about it. No, God is accessed by faith, not by facts, not by proof. If God wanted to use proof, he would have had ample opportunities to broadcast on the Olympics or to do some kind of other big spectacular. It doesn't seem to me that proof is what is called for. It appears God's will is for us to find him in the quiet center of our hearts, to find God in the middle of our lives. God can and does use everything in our lives, even addiction, to awaken our hunger for faith and quicken our spiritual growth. If I know God, it's not from proof or from phenomena or visions or uniqueness or special dispensation. I'm not a special case. I know God to the extent that I've looked for him, that I've been on the lookout, that I've sought him out, I've pursued his presence, I've asked for his help, and I've requested the gift of faith. And you know the sayings, to act justly and to love mercy and walk humbly with your God. These are ways to find God. When I reach for God, He reaches back. Whatever knowledge and closeness to God I may have today is a result of 42 years of reaching. Not because I'm a special case. If you're only just starting to know God, keep reaching. Keep exercising your faith. Keep practicing your principles. You'll get to know God like you got to know any friend. Gradually, over time, and by letting Him into your heart.
Coming up, a group that always brings...
I believe that we have to admit all of our feelings. Not to anybody else, but to ourselves. Even the ugly ones, and silly ones, and fussy ones. And even the beautiful ones. Nothing is beneath us, but denial can destroy us. I believe that in addition to abstinence from drugs, it's wise to try to deny yourself at least one other pleasure. It doesn't even matter what it is. Self-restraint helps us to grow up. In addition, I believe that if I want to flower, it's important for me to stretch and to imagine and aspire and visualize and risk and transcend. Sooner or later, I will find myself going on beyond what I thought to be possible. But I have to start by stretching. I also believe I have to let other people be who they are. I'm so relieved that I don't have to be in charge of the universe today. Or as my old sponsor had posted on his mirror, "You're fired, sign God." So that he would see that every morning. He didn't have to be in charge of the universe just for today. He would let God do that. I also believe we have to permit God to help us. And I've had addicts say, "Why would you need God's permission?" Well, that's because God is not a bully. God will not force His will down my throat. God doesn't make me do anything except breathe. But I have to let God into my heart. You know, if I'm on the line to God and I say, "God, help me," and I'll stand right here until I get the help, and then I go wander off somewhere else, it wasn't me who moved. I also believe that we shouldn't do or think anything to limit God. Don't try to put God in a box. Don't try to label. The more free you let God be, you put no limitations on God's nature, you won't limit His power. I'm allowed to let God be a mystery today. I don't have to force God into any kind of theology. I also believe in revering the presence of God within. That just means, the Hindus have a saying, namaste, where they greet you, and that means, "I revere the presence of God within you." It's a way of recognizing that God works through each other, and that God's presence is everywhere. But no, in me no less than in you. If I'm going to revere the presence of God in you, I need to revere it in me too. That adds to my self-respect. I also believe in making peace with my past. All that shit happened for a reason. I needed to go through it or I wouldn't be here today. I was an arrogant little kid. I was very intelligent and I looked down upon other people. And I probably had to be brought low in order for me to have some humility and have some sense of proportion and compassion for the suffering of others. Had I not suffered, I might not care about your suffering. I believe that we love more when we have suffered because we realize the preciousness of that love. As my God is, so am I. The kind of God I believe in is the kind of person I will be. If I have a vengeful, wrathful God, then I'm angry too. If I have a loving, caring, healing God, then that's me too. Likewise, if you give evil power, then it has power over you. I believe that God loves us so greatly that it would knock us down if we knew how much. I wouldn't be able to speak for 5 minutes or even get up for 10 minutes if I realized how much God loved me. But I don't have to return that love by loving God. I can love Him by loving others. It was the same, our debt to God is repayable to man. And I think the universe is a university, but Earth is just a kindergarten. The lessons we learn here are very basic spiritual lessons. I think we're on to something else. The purpose of ongoing creation after this point is to become more and more God-like as well as God-centered. That we're destined to be radiant beings, that we're destined to be co-creators. Maybe there's some unfinished corner of the universe that God wants me to go to and be a creator there. Work for him. I don't know. I don't have any hard and fast heaven story or reincarnation story. I don't know where I'm going to go where I die. All I know is I want to do the right thing. And whatever is waiting for me, I'll deserve it. I'll do my best here and prepare myself for there, whatever that happens to be. Or as Mark Twain said, let us so live our lives that when we die, even the Undertaker will be sorry. I believe also in deciding to be happy, joyous, and free. Abraham Lincoln said, people are about as happy as they have a mind to be. We decide to stop being mournful and sorry for ourselves and miserable. We decide to be happy, joyous, and free. It doesn't just erupt as though, Minerva from the head of Zeus. It doesn't suddenly erupt from our program. It's because we decided to be happy. I will do what it takes in my life to have a happy life and to have a happy and joyous heart. It's not going to just happen by accident. I pray for wisdom. And if I get some, it's because I asked for it. I act on truth, not because I deny anyone else's truth, but because I have one of my own. I use God as a model. God is creative. He's self-contained and radiant, powerful, positive, conscious and aware, wise, good, compassionate, content, and anonymous. And as my God is, so am I, if I try to be. There's some zingers, pieces of wisdom that I've heard anonymously from other sources that help me see God a little more clearly. One of which was, please don't pray for rain if you're going to complain about the mud. And another of which is, some people get a lot of pleasure just from being shocked at other people's sins. You hear that among the gossipers all the time. In other words, that anything that matters more to you than God is an idol. And one of my favorites is, what you are is God's gift to you, and what you make of yourself is your gift to God. Many pray not to find God's will, but to get his approval of their own. Men are great only when they are kind. Don't grumble because you have what you want. Because you don't have what you want. Be thankful you didn't get what you deserve. So live that when people speak evil of you, no one will believe it. When a man begins to realize the truth about himself, it lessens his desire to reform his neighbors. Good judgment often comes from experience gained through poor judgment. God loves his children not because of who they are, but because of who he is. And humans are made to run on love, and they do not function well on anything else. If I've gone on and on about God, it's because God is the center of my program. And all I can do about God is talk around God. I can't put my finger on God. The longer I'm clean and the more I'm into God and the more I'm into recovery, the less I'm into theology. The less I want to try to explain God, the more I want to see God acting in my life. It's sort of like what was said to Moses. When can I see your face? And he said, you can't see my face and live, but I'll let all my actions pass before you. God is too vast a subject for me to embrace completely. I will never comprehend God, but I can understand God. And if I understand God, it means that God and I have an understanding. We got a deal. I work for God, God works for me. Simple deal. If I do the right thing consistently, if I try to work for God in my life, and if I try to help others, God will be real to me, and God will help me. Now, I don't think that's an unfair deal. In fact, it's the best deal going. When I got here, if people had taught me or had told me, you know, all that stuff that you punished yourself for years over, you can stop punishing yourself for. All you have to do now is carry a message. I wouldn't have believed it. But so great is God's mercy that we don't have to pay forever for whatever we've done. We just have to make amends. I always try to bring a prayer when I speak. Close with it if I can. And I usually sit and meditate for a while and say, okay, God, what should I ask you for? And then I share it with others. And you can use this or any part of it. But dear God, please help me to be at peace with myself and at one with you. Please ease my transition from fool to sage. Please strengthen my faith, my confidence, and my resolve. Please imbue me with an instinct for holiness. Please ready me for greatness. Please calm my impatience and ease my doubt and soothe my sorrow. Please use me to raise the spirits and heal the souls of others. Please help me to learn how to let you into every part of my life. Please give me the will to endure boredom and uncertainty in pursuit of worthy goals. Please help me to unshackle my strength and free my vision from narrow, limited, fearful horizons. Please help me look for your presence and wisdom in all things. And please show me the light within me. Help me feel worthy of it. Show me how to use it and let me shine. Like I said, you can use any part of that if you want. Or better yet, make up a prayer of your own. The prayer that comes from my heart is the most real for me, and the prayer that comes from your heart is most real for you. And like I said, the more you talk to God like he's your buddy, like he's your friend, who would go anywhere with you, the more real his presence becomes. I usually try to avoid going into great depths about the steps when I speak, because I think that's between you, your God, and your sponsor. All I can say is, you know, that it's my job to become less powerless. The purpose of this program is to empower me. Some addicts exult in their powerlessness. They say, well, I'm powerless today. And yes, on one level I am. But God is powerful. And God lends me some of his power. And the steps and the program empower me. If I'm still as powerless today as the day I walked in, I might use any minute. Thank God each of us is a little less powerless today. And thank God for the program. Thank God for the Louisville committee that asked me to come and speak. Thank you very much for letting me share.